Okay, if you'd like to turn to page 1027, if you have a Bible there. If you haven't got a Bible and you'd like one, then there's ones over there, but it should be in the back of your seats. 1027, which should bring you to Gospel of John and chapter 19. Now, as Darren's already said, in our leading up to Good Friday, Easter Sunday, we've been looking at the trial of Jesus as it's recorded in the Gospel of John. Last week looked at the first half of that trial in chapter 18, verse 28 to 40. Mike took us through that. And I'm going to look at the second half of the trial today. But before we do that, what I need to do is sum up what was covered last week. So if you're here last week, a bit of an apology if you heard this before, or maybe you need reminding. It's just otherwise we're coming halfway through the trial and we may be wondering exactly what is happening. Okay, quick summary of last week then. Now, the trial of Jesus had come about because of the religious Jewish leaders' growing opposition to him. All through the Gospel of John, we read that they were really threatened by his popularity and his teaching. And as far back as chapter 11 in John, it's actually recorded that they decide to have him killed. From chapter 18 onwards, we have a record of how this, in effect, came to fruition. Jesus, at the beginning of chapter 18, is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's initially questioned in front of a Jewish religious court at night. First before someone called Annas, and then he's sent to the high priest of that time, who was called Caiaphas. And they decide to charge Jesus with blasphemy. Blasphemy is basically falsely claiming to be God, which in Old Testament law is a crime that was that did allow the death sentence. But they have a problem. The Romans are in charge of Jerusalem. They are the only ones who have the authority to enforce the death sentence. So, very early in the morning, Jesus is taken from the Jewish court and he's taken to the governor of Jerusalem, Pontius Pilate, in order to persuade him to carry out this death sentence on their behalf. Jesus is presented to Pilate as someone who's guilty of sedition. Sedition is wanting to cause an uprising or rebellion against the ruling authority. So they say to Pilate that Jesus has set himself up as a king, and therefore he opposes the authority of Rome. Pilate brings Jesus in, and he interrogates him about this, starting with the key question. Key question in this trial is, he says to Jesus, "Are you a king?" Jesus doesn't deny that he is a king, but nor does he accept it. He is a king, but not in the sense that Pilate or the Jewish leaders are using the term. Jesus does say to Pilate that he has got a kingdom, but then he also adds that his kingdom is not of this world. And at the end of this conversation with Pilate, Pilate is actually convinced that Jesus is not a revolutionary. He maybe was a religious fanatic, he may have been deluded, but he wasn't dangerous to Rome. And Pilate wants to release him. But how to spare Jesus and please the crowd and the chief priests at the same time? That is Pilate's dilemma in John chapter 19. So he comes up with a plan. It's the Jewish festival of Passover, and it was a Roman practice to release a prisoner on Passover as a conciliatory gesture. So Pilate comes up with this idea. Let's offer the release of Jesus as this year's amnesty. He calculates that if he puts him alongside a convicted criminal, then surely Jesus would be released. So he brings out someone called Barabbas. We're told in Luke's gospel that Barabbas was guilty of insurrection and was a murderer. Barabbas and Jesus stand before the crowd. To the shock of Pilate, when he asked who should be released, the name that rises up is Barabbas. And mingled with this is a growing chorus that Jesus should be crucified. Now we'll come back to that at the end. But this left Pilate in a huge dilemma. The crowd are now baying for the blood of Jesus, but Pilate knows, he knows in his heart that Jesus is not deserving of death. Big thing about the Roman Empire was justice. And so Pilate is uncomfortable about just sending this man to his death because he knows he is innocent. So what is he to do? Well, that's what we're going to read about now, and we're going to read it in two parts. First part is John 19, verses 1 to 11, and Edward's going to come up and read that to us.
Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, "Look, I'm bringing him out here to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When he came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to him, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jews insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked. Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have the power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin."
Thanks, Edward. Okay, so after Barabbas' release, Pilate tries something else. I think he calculates this. Perhaps the crowd would be satisfied if Jesus was flogged. If the crowd saw him beaten and broken, surely that would make them sympathetic towards Jesus, and that would be it. A Roman flogging involved a leather whip knotted and weighted with pieces of metal or bone, and many a prisoner didn't even survive the whipping. The trial of Jesus revolved around him being a king, so the soldiers decide that he should have a crown and a robe, and that was all in order to humiliate him. Pilate then returns to the crowd parading the beaten Jesus, hoping that the sight of a flogged and humiliated prisoner would arouse pity in their hearts. But no. Their response is to cry, "Crucify, crucify." Pilate is now desperate. Once again, he talks with Jesus, and Pilate reminds Jesus of his authority as a Roman governor, asserting that he has the power over Jesus to either free him or to crucify him. But if he did have this authority, and if he does believe Jesus to be innocent, why doesn't he release him? Jesus' last words to Pilate are a reminder that ultimately all authority is given by God. Jesus then stays silent and he says nothing more. But Pilate still wants to release Jesus. So what happens to break his will? What happens to bring him to a place where he is willing to hand Jesus over to be crucified? Edward will finish reading the account of.
From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, But the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Turning point comes in verse 12. I'll read it again. It says, "From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, 'If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar.'" One interesting fact about the Roman Caesars was that they had huge statues of themselves. They were larger than life images, but they weren't set primarily in Rome, but over all the provinces that Rome had conquered. Why? Well, it was to show people who their local people who their rulers were. So they would look at these big images of the emperor and say to themselves, "He is the one who rules over us. He is the one who we actually owe allegiance to. He is the one we must answer to." And there would have been statues like this in Jerusalem. Pilate was the governor of this province. He was in charge. His word was law. He could actually execute people if he wanted to, and he could let them go if he wanted to. But he had a very vulnerable point, and the crowd at the climax of the trial seemed to know what that vulnerable point was. And it was this. Pilate was very concerned about what people would think about him back in Rome. He wanted to be known as a friend of Caesar because he wanted the power, the privilege, the status that went with being a governor in Jerusalem. The last thing Pilate wanted was that a complaint against him would get back to his imperial master in Rome. He knew he should set Jesus free, but it's like his own interests and self-protection prevented him from doing so. So, after verse 12, very quickly it happens, he yields to this clamoring crowd and he sends Jesus to be crucified. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to give you 30 seconds. And the question is this: talk to your neighbour. What is your verdict of Pilate? What word would you use to describe Pilate after this trial? So you could be in twos or you could be in threes. Very quickly, 30 seconds, what's your verdict of Pilate? Okay, I'll just stop you there. There's not a right or wrong answer. I'm not going to say no, that's not true. You know, you've heard the trial. What would be just some people call out? What's your verdict of Pilate? How would you describe him? Some words you think that describe Pilate?
Weak.
Shallow, weak, pressure. Coward, pressured. Darren knows pressure. See, he's got sympathy with him. Yeah, trapped. Yeah, pressured, trapped. Coward, weak. Any other ones?
Afraid.
Yeah. 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 He's got this. He's in a huge dilemma, isn't he? Huge dilemma. Amen. Should we close in prayer? And that was the main lesson of today, okay? Very interestingly, John records all these details. In verse 8, we're told that Pilate was very afraid. And that was before they even said about we're going to tell Caesar if you let him go. You ask the question, afraid of what or whom? And I think the answer is, did he not fear man more than he feared God? Did he not, in a sense, value his reputation and his position as the governor more than he valued truth and justice? To say this, Pilate was a cruel man. He showed that when he had Jesus flogged. But he was also a fearful man. And I want to say that is a terrible combination for someone who has got power and authority. Was Pilate a coward? Well, if the definition of a coward is to know what is right but to be too fearful to do it, then I kind of think Pilate was. But should we be really quick to condemn Pilate? Some people said he was pressured. He was trapped. Isn't it so easy for us to fear other people more than we fear God? Are we not tempted to put our own needs above even what we know to be right and God's will? And I kind of think before we jump in and condemn Pilate, we should examine our own hearts. What about the chief priests? How do they emerge from this trial? I won't ask you to do that as another exercise, but how do they come out of this trial? Let me remind you what happens when they first bring Jesus to Pilate. It's 18 verse 28, and it says this. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanliness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. It was the Passover. It was a very holy, still is, time in the Jewish calendar. And so when they come to Pilate's palace, they refuse to enter because they must keep the Old Testament law. After all, their purpose was actually to teach and uphold the law of God. And isn't this a kind of an irony going on? To prevent ceremonial uncleanliness, they refuse to enter the Roman palace. While they're doing this, they're plotting the murder of an innocent man. And just as the actions of Pilate, I think, should cause us to examine our own hearts and motives, then I kind of think so should those of the chief priests while this is going on. And is it not a warning to guard against wanting to be seen by everyone as outwardly good and religious, to have the appearance of righteousness, but somehow to be inwardly disconnected from what really is an outward show? And there's a really striking contrast to how the chief priests respond at the beginning of the trial when they're not even going to enter this palace. And what happens at the end of the trial? If it started with them being really concerned to keep the law of God, look at how it finishes. Chapter 19, I'll take it from verse 14. It says, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. Here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews, but they shouted, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priest answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. At the climax of all this, the chief priests declare this, we have no king but Caesar. Now, I want to say this, that was a devastating thing for them to declare. In saying that, they were betraying everything that they stood for. The scriptures that they would have known absolutely thoroughly spoke of God only as king, and any pagan ruler as a pretense. And so shouting this out at the end of the trial, it's more than a compromise, it's a capitulation. And it's at these words that Pilate hands Jesus over to be crucified. Here's another question. As Jesus is being handed over to be crucified, who had the power and the authority as this trial is going on? Now, on the surface, if you read it, it looks like to be a power battle between Pilate and the Jewish leaders, with Jesus somehow standing helplessly between them. Pilate actually has all the earthly authority here, but he doesn't get his own way. The Jewish leaders don't have the earthly authority, but because they resort to manipulation and compromise, in the end, they do get what they want. Yet, as Jesus is handed over to be crucified, are not the hearts of Pilate and the Jewish religious leaders exposed? And what do we see? Cowardice, cruelty, compromise. But surely what we see is not just their hearts, but actually, if we're honest, the hearts of us all. Is this not the human heart? And is it not the power and authority with Jesus on this trial? For what we ultimately see is not Jesus on trial before the chief priests and Pilate. What we see is them on trial before him. Was it not Jesus who revealed what was in their hearts, showing the whole world and for all time what was hidden there? Does that not show us that even when he's on trial, even when he's beaten and humiliating, Jesus is still king? And as he's led away to be crucified, is it not a reminder of all those Old Testament prophecies that tell us that God will send his royal ruler to suffer? Three things about the suffering of Jesus that we must not lose sight of. It says at the end, finally Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Jesus suffered. Three things I want to say about that suffering quickly to finish. Jesus suffered first, innocently. It's really striking that in the account of the trial, three times Pilate declares that Jesus is innocent. Three times he says this: I find no basis for this charge against him. After having Jesus flogged, Pilate brings Jesus out wearing a crown of thorns, dressed in a purple robe, and he declares, "Here is the man." Now, in the older translation, it reads, "Behold the man." And actually, if I say this to you, that is the one I kind of prefer and I'll refer to now. Pilate looks and he says to the crowd, "Behold the man." And as we behold him at this point, when he's just been brought out, humiliated, beaten, just been flogged, what do we behold? What does John, the writer of the Gospel, want us to behold? Well, right at the beginning of the Gospel, John tells us that Jesus is the true image of God. Jesus is the one who has brought God's wisdom and revelation into the world. He is the one who has made the invisible God visible. He is the living embodiment of God. And the fact that he's just been flogged and humiliated, the fact that all his rebel subjects can do is to mock and scream for his blood, doesn't change who Jesus is, and actually doesn't change that he is revealing God to us. And as Jesus stands there silent with a crown of thorns and a purple robe, what do you see? For me, it's a picture of the living, loving God who has come in person into our world that he has made, but has rebelled terribly, terribly against him. We see a God who chose not to come as a superhero, sweeping through the rebel state with horses and chariots, defeating this rebellion in a blaze of glory. No, instead, he chose to come as a suffering servant. The phrase, "Behold the man," hangs over the whole of chapter 19 as Jesus now goes to the cross. At the outset of his gospel in chapter 1, John declares this: the Word became flesh. Meaning, basically, Jesus is the true and ultimate revelation of God for us. And what we see at this point is the living, loving, bruised and bleeding God. As the prophet Isaiah foretold about this suffering servant many years before, he was despised and rejected by others. He was a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one whom people hide their faces, he was despised and we held him in low esteem. And here is that prophecy being fulfilled. And it tells us that God in Christ suffered through no fault of his own, and that he's able to sympathize and strengthen us in our suffering too. Yes, Jesus was innocent. He suffered unjustly. But let's be clear that he also suffered intentionally. It was always the intention of Jesus to go to the cross. It's there throughout the whole of John's gospel. Right at the beginning of chapter 18, as the soldiers were looking to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, it says this: Jesus, knowing all that was about to happen to him, went and asked them, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And he intentionally handed himself over to them. He knew exactly what lay ahead. He accepted it. He embraced it. He willingly walked that road to the cross. Now, from a human standpoint, the trial and subsequent crucifixion of Jesus was actually a travesty. It was an innocent man who's condemned to death, the victim of cruelty, the victim of violence, the victim of injustice. But from a divine point of view, it was the fulfillment of prophecy and the accomplishment of the will of God. Now, it doesn't mean we can excuse the cowardness of Pilate, the cruelty of the soldiers, the compromise and the capitulation of the chief priests. But Jesus remains the king in charge and carries his authority all the way through this. Though appearances on that day were very, very deceptive, Jesus was always, always in control of his destiny. And if it was intentional, then what was the intention? Again, Isaiah tells us in his prophecy. Surely he took up our pain and he bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgression. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds we are healed. Finally, Jesus suffered in our place. Let's go back to the point where Pilate brings out Barabbas, who the crowd shouted for to be released instead of Jesus. Could I ask the question, why did the crowd shout for Barabbas and not Jesus? Well, one reason could be that national feelings always increased during the Passover, and maybe they thought a vote for Barabbas was a vote against the oppression of the Roman rule. Maybe the crowd were disappointed that Jesus himself didn't lead a popular uprising to overthrow Rome. Perhaps they hoped that the triumphal entry that Darren talked about at the beginning on Palm Sunday, a week before, they really hoped it would be the start of some sort of great Jewish liberation. Or maybe the fact that the crowd shouted Barabbas says something very raw, and it says something very real about our natural inclination to rebel against God's rule. I have to say, as I prepare this, I wonder who I would have shouted for. And I have to tell you, I've got a strong suspicion I would have been very easily swept along with everyone else. What about you? Where would you have stood in that crowd? I want you to finish now to use your imagination and put yourself into the shoes of Barabbas, right at the moment that he's released. Remember, he was expecting to be crucified imminently that morning in an hour or so. And then suddenly, like that, he's a free man. Instead, it was Jesus, not him, who was led away to be hung on a cross. I want you to imagine you were Barabbas and you joined the flow of the crowd on that day. who loved to go and witness Roman executions. If you were in the crowd watching and looked at Jesus between the two other condemned men, what do you think would have gone through your mind? Surely, if there had been any sense of justice, you would have thought this: that should have been me. Do we not, or should we not, all stand in the shoes of Barabbas when we look at the cross of Christ? There is a theological phrase to describe what happened in the death of Jesus on the cross, and it's this: penal substitution. It seems maybe an ugly phrase, it may go well over your head, but it does actually sum up a beautiful truth. It very simply means a life in exchange for a life, a death for a death, the guilt of one being taken instead by another. And at the cross we have a guilty world of which we are all part, and a perfect, innocent Jesus actually swapping places, one taking the place of the other. And on that day, Barabbas, though deserving of punishment before him and in no position to do anything about it, goes free. And Jesus, though innocent of any crime, dies in his place. Yes, you could say Jesus is on the cross because of cowardice, because of cruelty, corruption, plots, schemes, betrayals, lies and denials. But ultimately, Jesus is on the cross, yeah, not only because of those things, but also because of the amazing sovereign love of God. No one seemed to recognize that on that day, certainly not Pilate or Caiaphas. But John, along with the other gospel writers, wants us to see this. This is what the cross means. This is what truth is. Truth is what Jesus is. And truth is Jesus dying for Barabbas, for the crowd that mocked him on that day. It is Jesus dying for the world. And thank God, the truth is Jesus dying for you and for me.